session number 9944, Reel 1.
Mr. Garrod, Reel 1. Can you tell me about your family background before the war, Mr. Garrod?
Yes, well, my father was an Air Force officer. The first thing I can remember about my family life, I think, was in Andover, when he was on the staff college there. I have one sister, by the way, the only other member of the family. But we used to live in a bungalow in Andover next to Lee Mallory, another name who may be remembered, another Air Force name. Then, well, my schooling, I think the most significant part from the point of view of these purposes is at Bradfield. I went to Bradfield, following my father there, Bradfield College in Berkshire. Got all my usual certificates and so on. And then, in about 1938, I was preparing to go to Oxford. I went to a special Crammer, I think, in order to help me to get entrance into Oxford. But of course, the war came first. And I decided, as I'd always been interested in aircraft, to get some sort of employment associated with aircraft and helping the war effort. And I joined the Hawker Aircraft Company at Kingston, later at Brooklands, as an apprentice. I was involved in various jobs, of all kinds of jobs, mainly associated with a hurricane fighter. Then I went on a short course with Rolls-Royce at Hucknall to acquaint me with the installation of Merlin engines into both hurricanes, and as it happened, because Wellingtons, which were produced at Brooklands on the other side of the airfield. And that's what I was doing when the time came for me to join the ATA. Do you want to stop there?
How did you first become involved in flying?
Yes, well, my father taught me to fly in an RAF aircraft, De Havilland Gypsy Moth mainly, but of course he could never send me solo. I think my first flight with him, I've actually got it in his logbook, must have been about 1935 or 6. I was only 14 or 15. He seemed to think I had a natural ability as a pilot. He was then based, I think, at Sheerness. He commanded the armament group of the Air Force. He could never send me solo, but when he learnt that I was reasonably capable, he took me around on what he called moral solo. He would sit in the back, he'd turn me with his arms folded. He'd let me do all the takeoffs, the circuits, and even the landing, which was a very brave thing for him to do, because we could easily have had a minor catastrophe on landing, without him saying a word. And so I felt fairly confident about flying, certainly a light aeroplane like that, by 1937 or so.
Was it known officially that you were flying at that age?
I don't think it was against Air Force regulations. I think the Air Force was always prepared to give young men air experience, because I know another Air Force officer, Mellish, who had a son about the same age as myself, Tog Mellish he was known as, he taught his son to fly in exactly the same way. And I don't think my father would ever have contravened RAF regulations. I think much the same thing probably applies today. I think the Air Force will always be willing to give people air experience. Whether they'll allow them to land expensive Air Force aircraft, I have rather doubt. But this is a little Gypsy Moth, which was a communications aeroplane, only about 100 horsepower. Very nice little aeroplane to fly.
How easy was it for somebody of your age to fly then?
Well, I took to it quite well. I don't know why. I suppose some pilots have a natural ability. I found that two of my sons, who I used to take flying, and I think my second son, who's now an airline pilot, it was after I'd taken him night flying, and he'd shown quite an aptitude even at flying at night. He didn't get disorientated, his coordination was good, He was smooth and an easy, natural pilot. He said to me, "Dad, this is what I want to do." And he decided then and there he was going to take up flying as his career. And I don't know whether it's ingrained in your makeup, I don't know what, but I never found a problem in doing a coordinated turn and so on right from the start.
Did you consider joining the RAF yourself?
Well, yes, but I already knew by 1935, I think, that I had an eyesight problem and I was wearing spectacles. And I hoped I would get by, because one eye would just about get through, I think, but the other one not. And so I knew that this was going to be a problem.
Did you actually apply?
I made some inquiries, but I never actually applied, because I really knew it was hopeless. But I did, for a time, join the Central Medical Establishment at the Royal Air Force, and I think it was Air Vice Marshal Livingston who was in charge of it at that time, when a group of something like 15 or 20 of us, most of them existing RAF personnel who were either wanted to be pilots and already in the Air Force but weren't passing the eyesight standards, or others who hoped for some reason to get into flying, we were made guinea pigs for a very early form of contact lens, which none of us could wear for even up to an hour without streaming eyes and impossible to carry on. So that experiment, as far as I know, was disbanded there and then. Then I knew I could never get through to flying that way.
Was there a ban on wearing spectacles then as a pilot?
I think so. I think it's probably changed a bit now, but I don't know the present position for the service pilot, but through contacts with my son and so on, I believe that they realise that they'd be foolish to be quite so tight as the service are in eyesight requirements for civil pilots, and quite a number of aging civil pilots now wear glasses. But I can't really answer that question with full authority, but I think a service pilot would still have a problem.
When you were learning with your father, did you find it a problem, your eyesight?
No, not at all. Of course, I suppose I wore spectacles under goggles, I'm not quite sure, open cockpit. No, I never found it a problem. And in fact, when I'd been accepted for flying later, this is jumping on a bit, I just thought I'd test myself, perhaps a bit dangerous, by removing either my spectacles or my corrected goggles and landing the aircraft without them. And I never found a difficulty, although I'd been told by the Central Medical Establishment that because I had a slightly lazy eye, focusing and therefore judging your height off the ground could well be a problem. But I never found it to be so.
Could you tell me now how it was you actually came to join ATA?
Well, how I came to join ATA? Well, my father, I think, clearly realised that I dearly wanted to fly, and I believe felt that I was a fairly natural pilot. And he must have pulled strings behind the scenes, which I can't tell you too much about. I simply don't know, because I simply had a letter one day saying, would I report to Hatfield for a general flying test. This was the Joan Hughes, one of our most remarkable lady pilots in ATA, and I don't think she knew what my background was, I'm not sure, but she gave me an air test and said that's okay. And so then I was in at Hatfield, where they had this acceptance flight. I think they were all lady pilots there, and they bought pilots up to what I would now think to be the private pilot's license standard, the sort of standard which pilots attain at around 30 hours flying instruction and solo. And then I seemed to be in. I was in ATA.
How did you feel going on your test flight when you hadn't flown for some time?
Well, yes, it's quite true. I hadn't flown for some time. I don't think it's something you really forget. It was a simple aeroplane. It was a Tiger Moth, as far as I can recall. I'm sure it was a Tiger Moth, very similar to the aeroplane my father had instructed me on. And I dare say I was a bit rough in my flying, but presumably a capable instructor like Joan Hughes realised that I had the basics all right, but I don't remember feeling particularly anxious. My first solo, of course, was a tremendous feeling of elation, as it is with anybody, but I never felt scared or anything. I felt I could do it, and away we went.
Did you have to have a medical when you applied?
I must have had to have medicals in ATA. I don't remember too much about that, and they must have realised about my eyesight. But then, of course, we had many pilots with eyesight deficiencies. We had one very good friend of mine, Stan Dew, who had only one eye. Now, how he came to judge the height of landing, I simply don't know, because I used to try sometimes, knowing him, with one eye, and I couldn't go through with that. That was really an experience.
What was the training that they actually gave you?
Well, after you'd passed out of the acceptance flight, I went to White Waltham. I think it changed through the war quite a bit. And there you learnt to fly cross country. This was very important to ATA because, as you may know, we didn't have navigators. We were the pilot navigators. We mainly flew alone. In all aircraft, up to large twin-engined aircraft, beyond that four-engined aircraft, you had to carry a flight engineer because some of the operations couldn't be reached by the pilot in flight. But cross-country flying was very important. You had to get to know the country like the back of your hand, because there were occasions when, and it's happened to me once, when you were given an aeroplane to fly, which you'd never seen before, from an airfield you'd never been to before, to an airfield you've never been to before. And of course, getting used to an aircraft that you weren't acquainted with, it was no good if you didn't know the country and could really grip your way around automatically. So I think I did about 50 or 60 hours cross-country flying, and they tried to give you an assortment of aircraft to fly so that you wouldn't get too used to one particular type, which of course would have ill-suited you for the later kind of flying you were going to be doing with any type, any day, anywhere. And then when you passed out of the cross-country flight, I think it was the first sort of important stage, you got your wings, you got your uniform as a third officer, I think I'm right about this, about this time anyway, and you joined your first, you could call it an operational unit, your first ferry unit as a junior pilot.
Did you have any ground lectures at all?
Well, this came a little later on. You were then called Class 1 by ATA terms, which meant you could fly light single-engined aircraft. I think the biggest that you might have come your way would be the Fairey Swordfish, which was, although a big aeroplane, was a simple biplane, just really a sort of overgrown tiger moth from the pilot's point of view. But then, after about maybe 120 hours or so, I was selected for what was called Class 2 conversion. This enabled you to fly high-powered, single-engined aircraft, Hurricane, Spitfire, Mustang, all that lot. And before, or as part of that course, you were given a very good ground instruction, a man called Captain Gribble, who came from the old British Airways, and he was wonderful at doing it. Because you had to learn all sorts of things. For example, RAF pilots only had to know perhaps two or three machines in their operational life, but they had to know them in considerable depth. They had to know about armaments and so on. But we had to be able to understand the whole range of engine systems, starting systems, hydraulic systems, and so on. And this is where we got this excellent training. Went on, I think, for nearly a month. And then you did the flying training, which in my case was Harvard, with a man called Tex Pierce, for whom I'm very grateful, because he taught me unofficially simple aerobatics, which weren't encouraged in ATA. And I hope this isn't wandering too much, but some months later, when I was in an aeroplane called a Defiant, and inadvertently entered low cloud, only to find my instruments were all haywire, my gyro instruments, I think if he hadn't taught me aerobatics, I wouldn't instinctively have rolled out very close to the ground when I came out of cloud and probably saved my life, I don't know. And then the master, that was a British wooden trainer, much more like a British fighter than the Harvard, which was rather heavy and slow. And then you went on to the battle trainer, where I had a little incident which I could record if you wish. The first experience that things could go wrong was with an instructor was called Rambo, I remember, R-E-M-B-A-U-T. I've never met him since. But the battle trainer was an old aeroplane converted to a trainer from a bomber, and the pilot was all right, set up in front, right behind the engine, the pupil pilot. The instructor was right behind in the former gunner's seat. Couldn't see a thing. It was way back near the tail, almost. Quite a big aeroplane. And he had very rudimentary controls in his cockpit. He might have had a throttle, and that's about all. So they were very brave men, the instructors on battles. And after he'd shown me a circuit or two, he told me to have a go. And I got up about 300 or 400 feet, I suppose, undercarriage just retracted, and there was a thump and a shudder, and a lot of vapor started coming out of one set of exhausts, and we lost a lot of power. And I was linked to this instructor, not by a modern sophisticated headphone system, but by a thing was called the Gosport tube. It was just a bit of plumbing, really. You had headphones, well, like a stethoscope and a voice pipe. And, of course, you could hardly hear what he was saying in the best of times, but he started shouting things at me, which I couldn't really understand. It was sounding rather like this. And I didn't quite know what he wanted me to do, but I found that up front I could keep the aeroplane in the air. He was smothered with all this smoke and fumes, which completely covered his cockpit, so he couldn't see a thing, I gathered that much. So I struggled round the circuit, about 90 miles an hour, which was rather close to the stalling speed, and trundled it into the airfield, just got the undercarriage down in time, rolled to a halt, and the engine stopped of its own accord, and we hopped out and went to the tail as the fire truck rushed up, because we'd left quite a trail of smoke and stuff as we came in. And he then told me, as he shakily lit a cigarette, that he'd wanted me to put it down somewhere in a field, which I should have done, really. But he said, nevertheless, you've got it back, so I'll have a word with the chief instructor, see if I can get you a commendation. I remember hanging about, it's amazing how well I remember all this, hanging about all day, waiting to be called, you know, young ace who'd just landed a damaged battle of a partial engine failure. And the chief flying instructor, his name was Gale, called me in, and I thought, you know, I'd get a nice handshake. But nothing of the sort. He said, that was a disgraceful bit of flying. You should have put that aeroplane down. I don't mind you risking your own neck, but I'm not going to have you risking the lives of my valuable instructors. I had a good mind to endorse your logbook. This meant something in red ink written across it. But since you did get it down, we'll call it quits. But don't you ever dare do such a foolish thing again, and so on and so on. So I walked out, tail between my legs. And a few days later, I saw the aeroplane broken up and being taken away in pieces. You know, it was no good anymore anyway, so all my heroics had come to nothing.
How did that affect your confidence?
Oh, not too much, really. It's astonishing when I look back on it how little mechanical failure there was of any kind. When you think that this was the age when the monoplane had not long been introduced into service flying, and it was built in a completely different way, metal skinned and so on. All the rapid training there must have been, both of those who made aeroplanes and serviced them. I had only about 7 occasions with engine or mechanical failure of any sort, and only half of them were total, the rest were partial, and very little other failure at all. I think a great tribute to what the British nation can do when it's felt like it. It didn't shake my confidence a bit, nor did the other episodes really. But I never had to make an actual forced landing again through loss of power. It was, all seemed to happen on multi-engine aircraft, and you could drag them in on the other engine if you kept your wits about you.
Could you tell me more about these other incidents you had?
Yes, one was in a Wellington. I was flying Ratcliffe, I forget the airfield I landed at, not far from Ratcliffe in Leicester, and again there was a bang and a shudder, and one of the engines had obviously gone wrong. I tried a few remedies, but I realised that something had broken up inside the engine. It was almost shaking itself out of the frame, So I put that down at this airfield on one engine. It was no trouble. We were trained in this, you know. We all pilots today in civil airlines, you know, get very intensive training in single engine flight and so on, or flight with one engine failed. So that went off all right. And then later on, there was an incident in a Beaufort, which wasn't a particularly easy aeroplane to fly on one engine. It was overloaded and had rather lacking in power, and a single fin and rudder, which didn't enable you to keep straight very easily if one engine failed. And I did get a commendation for that from ATA, because I had an engine failure there at only about 300 feet, and it was very difficult to climb thereafter, full of fuel, and a rather poor performer on one engine anyway. And I realized that because one engine had gone, the hydraulic pressure supply would be much reduced, and the undercarriage would take a long time coming down. So I was ready to fire the undercarriage down on an emergency system. It had a sort of cartridge which blew the undercarriage down very rapidly. If I'd lowered it too early, I wouldn't have been able to hold height and reach the airfield, but I fired it down very close to the edge of the airfield and landed with the wheels down, did no more damage to the aircraft. So they gave me a commendation for that.
What did getting a commendation mean?
Well, you get a... I've got it here somewhere. You get a certificate from ATA. I think it's recorded in my... well, here it is, actually, this particular incident. You just get that endorsed on your flying record. I don't think they gave me any money or a medal.
What other incidents did you have?
Well, they were all... you mustn't, I think, play by the say so too much on the incidents, because they were remarkably few, but... I got caught out at night once, my own stupid fault, and managed to get down in Warwick in Northern Ireland. But they had the landing lights ready. I got caught in bad weather, made a few attempts to descend below the cloud, realized that it was very, very hazardous, and climbed up through the cloud and flew west, because I knew from the weather situation that there was a clearance from the west. And fortunately broke cloud somewhere off Northern Ireland, groped my way to the coast. Of course, in days of blackout you were lucky to find much light about. I probably went very close to Era, because there were some well lit towns or villages I could see away to the south, and I saw this runway, which was Limavady, Northern Ireland, down in the dark. We weren't supposed to go night flying, as you probably know. There was considerably no need. And I had another episode in a typhoon where, in conjunction with another friend who you may be interviewing, I don't know, Johnny Jordan, we, had a bit of a bravado. We took off in the dusk and got to Manston in the dark. But we knew much more what we were doing then, and we had VHF radio by that time. And it was not nearly such a hazardous business by that time to do a little bit of night flying.
Was there any official censure, though, for night flying?
No, I got censured for aerobatics once or twice, as you see here, which is another thing we weren't supposed to do. But I was glad at the time I indulged in aerobatics, because there were always the odd incidents when you had an aeroplane with peculiar characteristics. For example, you might get an aeroplane where you realise the airspeed indication was completely wrong. And if you landed in accordance with your indicated airspeed, I mean, you could go clean out the other end or else stall on the approach. And I used to stall aircraft without any worries at all when that happened. And it was only the confidence that I'd been given by Tex Pierce on the Harvard and my own unofficial experiments in aerobatics, which made me quite happy to do that, because... some aeroplanes would go straight into a spin if you stalled them without giving you much warning, and an aerobatic training would enable you to come out with competence which otherwise, I don't know, you might not be able to do.
But was it not ATA policy then that you should do aerobatics?
No, they would teach you spin recovery in light aircraft. Now, we were told, of course, you are ferry pilots, you must, the great thing is to get the thing there safely. We flew at quite low powers, we preserved our engines as much as we could. The cruising recommendations, or the power recommendations for cruising flight that we were given, were weigh down on what the Air Force would use, because we wanted to be kind to the engines. The purpose was to get the thing to the other end in a perfect state if you could, and as little used or as little harmed by your flying of it as you could possibly manage. That was, I suppose, the objective.
How serious was it to be reprimanded for aerobatics?
Well, I was put off flying for 3 days by a very nice man called Commander Mercer, who could have done much more to me. So he grounded me for 3 days. I'm afraid that's endorsed on this document here somewhere. There, by the way, is the other... That's the finding I got for the landing on the Beaufort. But somewhere here, executing aerobatics at low altitude, loss of flying pay and subsistence allowance for 3 days. Well, that was Commander Marcel. He could have been much harder on me, and I'm very grateful to him for being so kind.
Can you tell me about the very first pool that you were sent to?
Well, I was kept for a while at White Waltham, and as a junior pilot, of course, much of what you did was flying the taxi aircraft around in order to retrieve our pilots and get them distributed to the various places where they had to pick up or land aircraft. We had quite a fleet of taxi aircraft, two kinds. The Fairchild was a single-engined aeroplane, American. It could take the pilot and three passengers with their parachutes, but it was pretty heavily loaded doing it. And then the Anson could take up to 13, I think, and that was the twin-engined taxi aircraft for the bigger jobs. And I think the ATA quite rightly thought that you should spend a lot of time flying these taxi aircraft around, because it showed you your way around the country and in the airfields. For example, places like Shawbury, we didn't go to the Air Force dispersal site on landing. We went to the 27MU dispersal site. Was a different part of the airfield, and you had to get to know your way around. And being a ferry pilot, a taxi pilot like this, helped you a great deal. And so you got very largely taxi jobs to give you a grounding in location of airfields and location of the sites you went to on airfields.
How confident were you at that point to ferry passengers?
Well, because if there was a senior pilot, he could very well take over then. You see, you'd only fly the aircraft, perhaps, empty to the destination. Very often they would let you fly, and effectively they got to know you, and they realised you weren't doing it too badly, they would let you fly. But that wasn't really a worry. You just took it as you found it. If they let you fly it, you were quite happy, and you had dual control on the Fairchild. If there was a nasty crosswind landing or something, the senior pilot would probably prefer to take over the aeroplane from you.
Was that all you did in your first ferry pool?
No, you would get the odd Tiger Moth and other ferry jobs to do. Tiger Moth flying, in fact, under those conditions, wasn't all that easy, because the Tiger Moth had a tail skid. It had no wheel brakes. It was very difficult to handle them on the ground, particularly when the wind was strong, and many of the Air Force airfields were hard runways by that time, not grass. And a Tiger Moth on a hard runway was very difficult to handle and very difficult to stop. There were no wheel brakes, and the tail skid, which was to act as a kind of brake on grass, of course, didn't work at all. So Tiger Moth flying, although it was a very simple aeroplane, was not something I always looked forward to when the wind was strong, and particularly if you had to land and refuel on some big airfield, it was all hard runways. But then you might have got the occasional swordfish to fly at that time, the big ferry biplane, which was quite an experience. Quite a big machine, about 600 horsepower engine.